moral dilemma of the six. The ancestors of each race had felt they had strong reasons to come so far in sneak ships, planting outlaw seed on a forbidden world. The scrolls spoke of crime blended with desperate hope. But Nello's son stressed only the felony. Moreover, Lark and his comrades planned finally doing something about it, a grand gesture at this year's gathering, atoning for generations of guilt with an act of devotion, both holy and terrible.
"What foolishness!" Nello had protested. "When civilization finally resettles this galaxy, there'll be no sign of our kind ever lived here, not if we live righteously, by egg and oath. What you plan will make no difference."
In any quarrel with Dwar, there would have been definite shouting. But Lark was even more frustrating to talk to, masking his purest heresy behind an obstinate civility he must have inherited from his mother.
"It doesn't matter if our crime is never discovered, Father. What matters is we don't belong here. We simply should not exist."
Villagers saluted their paper crafter as Nello and Pretty passed by. But today he only glowered, wishing acridly that his offspring wouldn't vex him so, first by neglecting his wishes, then by inflicting the ferment of their disturbing ideas. Several boats lay berthed at the town dock. Nimble, sleek-furred, newer beasts scampered across the masts, tending lines and camouflage shrouds, as their kind had been trained to do for centuries by the tall, long-snouted Hoon. The crew of one vessel helped some local men load a cargo of glass and metal, scavenged from a buoyer site upriver, destined for reprocessing by the smiths of Urtanjtown, or else bound for the dross pits far out to sea. Normally, Nello might have paused to watch, but Pretty tugged his sleeve, urging him upward into the blue-gray branches of the grove. As they turned, sudden shouts blared. Men dropped their burdens, and Hoon sailors crouched, splaying shaggy legs. Creaking tree trunks swayed like the ship masts as lines snapped and ripples stitched the water. A cloud of leaves poured from the forest, filling the air with spinning spiral forms. Nello recognized the basso rumble of a quake. Spine-tingling fear mixed with a strange thrill as he pondered whether to try for open ground. The tumult passed before he could decide. Branches kept swaying, but the walkway plank ceased vibrating and the watery ripples vanished like dreams. Relieved sailors snorted. Villagers made reverent hand gestures, for Jijo's flexings were sacred omens of the planet's healing force, even when they brought riotous ruin. Once, a century ago, a more violent quake had brought forth the holy egg, a blessing worth all the pain that accompanied its birth.
"Oh, Mother Jijo," Nello prayed as the last temblers faded. "Let things go well at gathering. Let the sages talk Lark and his friends out of their foolish plan. And perhaps," he dared add, "let Dwar also meet a girl of good family and settle down."
He knew better than to ask a third wish. Sarah wouldn't want him invoking a deity in her favor, not unless it were Ifni, the impartially capricious goddess of numbers and fate. When his pulse steadied, Nello signaled for Pretty to lead. Their route now spiraled up a massive garu, then along branch tops spanned by rope guideways. Nello's feet moved by habit, and he barely noticed the height, but the bundle of paper grew heavy in his hands. Sarah's treehouse perched so high that daylight spread for hours across one wattle wall. Nello gripped a guide rope while crossing the last stretch.
The naked sun was so unsettling he nearly missed noticing a square-sided cage made of braced rods that hung from a pulley next to Sarah's sky porch.
A lift? Why is a lift attached to my daughter's home?
Then he recalled.
It's because of the stranger.
Pungent aromas wafted from the house, tart, musty, and sweetly slimy. Peering inside, Nello made out slanting rays of light stabbing through louvered blinds. Sarah's voice could be heard, muttering unhappily from another room. His hand raised to knock on the jamb, but paused when a pair of shadows loomed from within. One, a cone-shaped outline of circular tubes, taller than Nello's head. Nubby feet propelled the bottommost ring, making squishy sounds as it neared. Two roller hoops framed the smaller creature, whose slim torso ended with a pair of graceful arms and four eye-tipped feelers that peered all ways at once. One wheel squeaked as this entity rolled forward, revealing the spotted brain case and droopy eye stalks of an elderly gekek. If any two citizens of Dolo Village could make Nello feel spry at his age, it was this pair. In all the life history of their two species, no gekek or treiki had ever climbed a tree.
"Cloudy skies, paper maker," the wheeled one said.
"Deep shade, Dr. Lorik, and to you, pharmacist."
Nello bowed twice.
"How goes your patient?"
Lorik's Anglic was superb after years serving Dolo's mostly human populace.
"Astonishingly, the injured man gained strength, soothed by Pazora's special unguents."
The doctor bent a stalk toward the Treiki, whose ninth torus looked flushed from hard medicinal labor.
"And helped by the care he receives in this clean air."
This was a surprise. The stranger had seemed a goner.
"But his wounds, the hole in his head."
Shrugging had originally been a human gesture, but no one did it with more poise than a gekek.
"A fatal mutilation, I feared. Clearly, the outlander owes his life to Pazora's secretions and your daughter's swift action, hauling him from that foul swamp."
The Treiki pharmacist then spoke, turning its jewel-like sense organs, its voice wavering like an untuned metal harp.
"I we help gladly, though our synthesis rings near swoon from the effort. Unguents of rare potency were needed, yet it seems difficult to please."
"How do you mean?"
"Only here, up high, where germs are scarce, might the work be done. Miss Sarah's abode is ideal, and she will let no other take the patient. Yet she complains so. Aggrieved, she speaks longingly of an end to her work disruption, toward getting us all out of her hair."
"It's just a metaphor," Lorik explained.
"As we assumed, its paradoxical dissonance I esteem highly. May herself understand that."
"I'll see that she does," Nello told Pazora, smiling.
"Thank you all, excellent Nellos,"
the young Treiki responded, slipping into plural form.
We hope for serene work when we return this evening."
Lork wrapped his eye stalks, and Nello needed no rauk to read the old gekek's silent laughter.
"Serenity is good.
he agreed dryly, coughing behind a hand. He braced the elevator cage, first for the heavy tray key to shuffle aboard. Then Lorik rolled in, his left wheel wobbling from untreatable degenerative axle disease. Nello pulled the signal rope, calling an operator far below to start the weight-driven winch.
"Has anything been learned about the stranger's identity?"
Lorik asked while waiting.
"Not that I heard, though I'm sure it's just a matter of time."
So far, even merchant traders had failed to recognize the unconscious man, implying he came quite a distance, perhaps from the coast settlements, or even the Vale. No one in Dolo knew Melina either when she arrived long ago, with a letter of introduction and a baby on her hip. The slope is a bigger place than we're used to thinking.
The Kekek sighed.
"We must resolve soon whether it will better serve the patient to send him on, now that he's stabilized, to be examined in—"
The cage shuddered, then dropped swiftly, cutting Lorik off mid-sentence.
"Ah, well," Nello thought, watching the car vanish steadily below moss-heavy branches. "That'd explain the shouting. Sarah wouldn't want her pet sent to specialists in Tarik Town, even if she does complain about disrupted work.
Would she ever learn? The last time Sarah's nurturing instincts took over, succoring a convalescing bookbinder in Byblos, it led to a love affair that ended in tragedy, scandal, and alienation from her guild. Nello hoped the cycle wasn't repeating.
Even now, she could win it all back, both her position and marriage to a respected sage. True, I never liked that sourpuss Tane. But he offers a more secure life than she'd have had with that frail lover of hers. Anyway, she can still do math while making me some grandkids.
The little chimp plunged into the house first. Sarah's voice called from shadows.
"Is that you, pretty? It's been nothing but interruptions, but I think I finally whipped that integral. Why don't you look it up?"
There was a flat sound, a large bundle landing on a table.
"Ah, the paper, wonderful. Let's see what the old man sent us this time."
"Whatever the old man sends is good enough for one who don't pay for it,"
Nello groused, shuffling while his eyes adapted. Through the gloom, he saw his daughter rise from a desk covered with notebooks and obscure symbols. Sarah's round face spread with a smile he always thought beautiful, though it might have helped if she'd taken more after her mother.
"My looks and Melina's wild brains. Not a blend I'd wish on a sweet lass."
"Father," she hurried over to embrace him, "you gave me a start."
Her black hair, cut like a boy's, smelled of pencil dust and Pizora's unguents.
"No doubt."
He frowned at the shambles of her quarters, worse now with a mattress by her desk, a jumble of texts, some bearing emblems of the great Byblos trove, lay amid notes on the new direction her research had taken, combining mathematics and linguistics, of all things. Pretty took one of Sarah's papers and perched on the stool. The chimp worked her lower lip, scanning one line of symbols at a time, silent collaborator in an arcane art Nello would never understand. He glanced toward the sleeping porch, where sunlight spread across a blanket, outlining two large feet.
"With both of the lads gone, I thought I'd come see how you're doing."
"Well, I'm all right, as you can see,"
she gestured, as if the fire trap of a treehouse were a model of home tending.
"And I have Pretty to take care of me. Why, I even recall to eat most days."
Well, he muttered. But Sarah had taken his arm and was gently maneuvering him toward the door.
I'll come visit tomorrow, she vowed. When Lorik and old Stinky want me out of the way, we'll go to Bellana's for a nice meal, hm? I'll even wear a clean gown.
Well, that'd be fine. He paused. Just remember, the elders will assign you help if all this gets to be too much fuss and work.
She nodded. I know how this looks to you, Father. Sarah's gone obsessive again, right? Well, don't worry. It's not like that this time. I just think this place is ideal for preventing infection of those horrid wounds.
A low moan floated from the back of the house. Sarah hesitated, then held up a hand.
I'll be a moment.
Nello watched her hasten toward the shuttered porch, then he followed, drawn by curiosity. Pretty was wiping the injured stranger's brow, while his dark hands trembled outward as if warding off something deadly. Livid scars laced the man's arms, and yellow fluid leaked through a gauze dressing near his left ear. The last time Nello had seen the man, his skin was ashen with a pallor of approaching death. Now the eyes with near black irises seemed to flame with awful passion. Sarah took the wounded man's hands, speaking insistently, trying to soothe the abrupt fit. But the outsider clutched her wrists, clamping down so hard that Sarah cried out. Nello rushed to her side, plucking vainly at the strong fingers gripping his daughter.
G-g-g-dow,
the stranger stammered, yanking Sarah toward the floor. At that moment, the sky cracked open. A savage roar blew in the shutters, knocking pottery off kitchen shelves. The entire garu tree leaned, as if a great hand shoved it, knocking Nello off his feet. With ringing ears, father and daughter clutched floor planks as the tree swung over so far, Nello glimpsed the ground through a gaping window. More crockery spilled. Furniture slid toward the open door. Amid a storm of swirling paper, Pretty shrieked, and the wide-eyed stranger howled in harmony. Nello managed one dumbfounded thought. Could it be another quake? The garu whipped them back and forth like beads in a rattle for a terrifying interval that felt like eternity, and must have lasted all of a minute. Amazingly, the house clung to its cleft between two branches. Vibrations thrummed along the tree's abused spine as the wail in Nello's skull abated at last, trailing to numbed silence. Reluctantly, he let Sarah help him rise. Together, they joined the stranger, who now clutched the windowsill with bone-white knuckles. The forest was a maelstrom of dust and fluttering leaves. No trees had toppled, much to Nello's surprise. He sought the great dam and found that it held, thank God. The paper mill appeared intact.
Look! Sarah gasped, pointing above the forest toward the southeast sky. A thin white trail showed where, high overhead, the air had been riven by something titanic and fast. Something that still sparkled in the distance as they glimpsed it streak past the valley's edge toward the white-tipped peak of the Rimmer Range. So high and so fleet it seemed, so arrogantly untimid, Nello did not have to speak his dread aloud. The same fear lay in his daughter's eyes. The stranger, still tracking the distant, dwindling glitter, let out a foreboding sigh. He seemed to share their anxiety, but in his weary face there was no hint of surprise.
Asks. Do you recall, my rings, how the Rothan ship circled thrice over the glade of gathering, blazing from its hot descent, chased by the roaring protest of a cloven sky. Stroke the wax of memory, and recollect how mighty the vessel seemed, halting dramatically, almost overhead. Even the human tribe, our finest tech crafters, stared in the round-eyed manner of their kind as the great cylinder, vast as a glacier, settled down just 90 arrow flights away from the secret sacred hollow of the Holy Egg. The people of the six races came before us, moaning dread. "Oh, sages, shall we flee? Shall we hide, as the law demands? Indeed, the scrolls so command us. Conceal your tents, your fields, your works, and very selves, for from the sky shall come your judgment and your scourge." Message casters asked, "Shall we put out the call? Shall villages and burgs and herds and hives be told to raise?" Even before the law was shaped, when our commons had not yet congealed out of sharp enmities, even then our scattered outcast bands knew where danger lay. We exiles on Jijo have cowered when survey probes from the Galactic Institutes made cursory audits from afar, causing our sensor stones to light with warning fire. At other times, shimmering globe swarms of Zang fell from the starry vault, dipping to the sea, then parting amid clouds of stolen vapor. Even those six times when new bands of misfits settled on this desert shore, they went ungreeted by those already here, until they burned the ships that brought them. Shall we try to hide? Recall my rings, the confused braying, as folk scattered like chaff before a whirlwind, tearing down the festival pavilions, hauling dross from our encampment toward nearby caves. Yet amid all this, some were calm, resigned. From each race, a few understood. This time, there would be no hiding from the stars. Among the high sages, Vubbin spoke first, turning an eye stalk toward each of us. "Never before has a ship landed right in our midst. Clearly, we are already seen." "Perhaps not," Urjas suggested in hopeful Galactic Seven, stamping one hoof. Agitated white fur outlined her flared, urish nostril. "They may be trekking emanations of the egg. Perhaps if we hide swiftly..." Urjas's voice trailed off as Lester, the human, rocked his head, a simple gesture of negation, lately fashionable throughout the commons, among those with heads.
"At this range, our infrared signatures would be unmistakable. Their onboard library will have categorized us down to each subspecies. If they didn't know about us before entering the atmosphere, they surely do by now."
Out of habit, we took his word for such things, about which humans oft know best. "Perhaps they are refugees like us," burst forth our Kewanish sage, venting hope from all five leg vents. But Vubbin was not sanguine.
"You saw the manner of their arrival. Was that the style of refugees, treading in fear, hiding from Ismanuti's stare? Did any of our ancestors come thus, screaming brutishly across the sky?" Lifting his forward eye to regard the crowd, Vubbin called for order. Let no one leave the Festival Valley, lest their flight be tracked to our scattered clans and holds, but seek all glaivers that have come to browse among us, and push those simple ones away, so our guilt won't stain their reclaimed innocence. As for those of the six who are here now, where the ship's dark shadow fell, we all must live or die as fate wills.
We sensed solidification among the rings of our body. Fear merged into noble resignation as the commons saw truth in Vubbin's words. Nor shall we scurry uselessly, he went on, for the scrolls also say, when every veil is torn, cower no more, for that day comes your judgment. Stand as you are. So clear was his wisdom, there rose no dissent. We gathered then, tribe by tribe, did we not, my rings? From many we coalesced as one. Together our commons turned toward the ship to meet our destiny.
Dwur. The weird Nur still dogged his heels, leering down at him from tree branches, being an utter pest. Sometimes the sleek, black-pelted creature vanished for a while, raising Dwur's hopes. Perhaps it finally had tired of dusty alpine air, so far from the swamps where the most Nur dwelled. Then it reappeared, a grin splitting its stubby snout, perched on some ledge to watch Dwur hack through thorn hedges and scramble over upended slabs of ancient pavement, kneeling often to check footprint traces of a runaway glaiver. The scent was already cool when Dwur had first noticed the spore just outside the glade of gathering. His brother and the other pilgrims had continued toward sounds of gala music floating from the festival pavilions. But alas for Dwur, it was his job to stop glaivers who took a strange notion to leave the cozy lowlands and make a break for perilous freedom. Festival would have to wait. The Nur barked high-pitched yelps, pretending to be helpful, its sinuous body streaking along at root level, while Dwur had to chop and scramble. Finally, Dwur could tell they were gaining. The glaiver's tired footprints lay close together, pressing the heel. When the wind changed, Dwur caught a scent. About time, he thought, gauging how little mountain remained before a cleft led to the next watershed. In effect, another world. Why do glaivers keep doing this? Their lives aren't so rough on this side, where everyone dotes on them. Beyond the pass, by contrast, lay a poison plain, unfit for all but the hardiest hunters. Or tourists, he thought, recalling Lena Strong's offer to pay him to lead a trip east, a journey whose sole aim was sightseeing. A word Dwur had only heard in tales from old Earth. These are crazy times, he thought. Yet the tour organizers claimed to have approval from the sages, under certain conditions. Dwur shook his head. He didn't need idiotic ideas clouding his mind right now, with a quarry just ahead. The Nur, too, showed signs of fatigue, though it kept snuffing along the glaiver's track, then rising on its hind legs to scan with black, forward-facing eyes. Suddenly it gave a guttural purr and took off through the montane thicket, and soon Dwur heard a glaiver's unmistakable squall, followed by the thud of running feet. Great, now he spooked it. At last, Dwur spilled from the undergrowth onto a stretch of ancient Boyer highway. Sprinting along the broken pavement, he sheathed the machete and drew his compound bow, cranking the string taut. Sounds of hissing confrontation spilled from a narrow side canyon,
forcing Dwyer to leave the old road again, dodging amid vine-crusted trees. Finally, he saw them, just beyond a screen of shrubs, two creatures poised in a showdown of sable and iridescent pale. Cornered in the slit ravine, the glaiver was obviously female, possibly pregnant. She had climbed a long way and was pulling deep breaths. Globe-like eyes rotated independently, one tracking the dark Noor, while the other scanned for dangers yet unseen. Dwyer cursed both of them, the glaiver for drawing him on a profitless chase when he had been looking forward to festival, and the meddlesome Noor for daring to interfere. Doubly cursed, because now he was in its debt. If the glaiver had reached the plains beyond the Rimmer Range, it would have been no end of trouble. Neither creature seemed to notice Dwyer, though he wouldn't bet against the Noor's keen senses. What is the little devil doing up here? What's it trying to prove? Dwyer had named it Mudfoot, for the brown forepaws marring an ebony pelt, from a flattish tail to whiskers that twitched all around a stubby snout. The black-furred creature kept still, its gaze riveted on the flighty glaiver. But Dwyer wasn't fooled. "You know I'm watching, show-off." Of all the species left on Jijo when the ancient Boyer departed, Dwyer found Noor the least fathomable. And fathoming other creatures was a hunter's art. Quietly he lowered the bow and unfastened a buckskin thong, taking up his coiled lariat. Using patient, stealthy care, he edged forward. Grinning with jagged, angular teeth, Mudfoot reared almost to the glaiver's height, roughly as tall as Dwyer's thigh. The glaiver retreated with a snarl, till her bony back plates brushed rock, causing a rain of pebbles. In her forked tail, she brandished a stick, some branchlet or sapling with the twigs removed, a sophisticated tool given the present state of glaiverdom. Dwyer took another step, and this time could not avoid crushing some leaves. Behind the Noor's pointy ears, gray spines jutted from the fur, waving independently. Mudfoot kept facing the glaiver, but something in its stance said, "Be quiet, fool." Dwyer didn't like being told what to do, especially by a Noor. Still, a hunt is judged only by success, and Dwyer wanted a clean capture. Shooting the glaiver now would be to admit failure. Her loose skin had lost some opal luster since leaving familiar haunts, scavenging near some village of the Six, as glaivers had done for centuries, ever since their innocence was new. Why do they do this? Why do a few try for the passes every year? One might as well guess the motives of a Noor. Among the Six, only the patient Hoon had a knack for working with the puckish, disruptive beasts. Maybe the Boyer resented having to quit Jijo and left Noor as a joke on whoever came next. A buzzing lionfly cruised by under filmy, rotating wings. The panting glaiver tracked it with one eye, while the other watched the swaying Noor. Hunger gradually prevailed over fear, as she realized Mudfoot was too small to murder her. As if to enhance that impression, the Noor sat back on its haunches, nonchalantly licking a shoulder. "Very clever," Dwyer thought, shifting his weight as the glaiver swung both eyes toward the hovering meal. A jet of sputum shot from her mouth, striking the fly's tail. In a flash, Mudfoot bounded left. The glaiver squealed, struck out with the stick, then whirled to flee the other way. Cursing, Dwyer sprang from the undergrowth. Moccasins skidded on spoiled granite, and he tumbled, passing just under the flailing club. Desperately, Dwyer cast the lariat, which tautened with a savage yank that slammed his chin to the ground. Though starving and weak, The glaiver had enough panicky strength to drag Dwyer for a dozen meters till her will finally gave out. Shivering, with waves of color coursing under her pale skin, she dropped the makeshift club and sank to all four knees. Dwyer got up warily, coiling the rope. "Easy does it. No one's gonna hurt you." The glaiver scanned him with one dull eye.
"Pain exists, marginally," she crooned in thickly slurred Galactic 8.
Dwyer rocked back. Only once before had a captured glaiver spoken to him. Usually they kept up their unsentient pose to the last. He wet his lips and tried answering in the same obscure dialect. "Regrettable. Endurance suggested. Better than death."
"Better?"
The weary eye squinted as if vaguely puzzled and unsure it mattered. Dwyer shrugged. "Sorry about the pain." The faint light drifted out of focus.
"Not blamed, Dwyer Melody, now ready to eat."
The flicker of intellect vanished once more under a bolus of animal density. Both amazed and drained, Dwyer tethered the creature to a nearby tree. Only then did he take account of his own wincing cuts and bruises, while Mudfoot lay on a rock, basking in the last rays of the setting sun. The Noor couldn't talk. Unlike the glaiver, its ancestors had never been given the knack. Still, its open-mouthed grin seemed to say, "That was fun. Let's do it again." Dwyer recovered his bow, started a fire, and spent the day's last half Medora feeding the captive from his meager rations. Tomorrow he'd find it a rotten log to root under for grubs, a favorite, if undignified, pastime for members of what had once been a mighty star-faring race. Mudfoot sidled close when Dwyer unwrapped some hard bread and jerky. Dwyer sighed and tossed some to the Noor, who snatched chunks out of midair and ate with dainty care. Then Mudfoot sniffed at Dwyer's gourd canteen. He had seen the beasts use gourds aboard hoon-crewed riverboats, so after a dubious pause, he pulled the cork stopper and handed it over. The creature used both six-fingered forepaws, nearly as deft as true hands, to adroitly slosh quick dollops over its tongue, smacking loudly. Then it poured the remainder over its head. Dwyer shot to his feet, cursing, but Mudfoot blithely tossed the empty vessel aside. Rivulets ran down its glossy back, dribbling dark splatters in the dust. The Noor chirped happily and began to groom. Dwyer shook the canteen, winning a few drops. Of all the selfish, ungrateful! It was already too late to hike to the nearest stream, down a narrow, treacherous trail. A waterfall growled close enough to hear, but over a Medjura away by foot. This was no crisis. He'd done without before. Still, the sound would give him dry mouth all night long. "Never stop learning," said the sage Uruhals. Tonight, Dwyer had learned one more thing about Noor. All told, the price of the lesson was pretty cheap. He decided to arrange for a wake-up call. For that, he would need a clock teat. There were good reasons to get an early start. He might still make it back to the yearly gathering of the six before all the unpledged human boys and girls chose partners for Jubilee dancing. Then there was his annual report to Danil Ozawa and Lena Strong's ridiculous tourism idea to oppose. Also, if he led the glaiver away before dawn, he just might manage to leave Mudfoot snoring by the coals. Noor loved sleep, almost as much as upsetting the routines of villagers, and this one had had a long day. So after supper, Dwyer brought forth a sheaf of paper folders, his cache of practical things. Many of the wrappers had come from his brother's wastebasket, or Sarah's. Lark's handwriting, graceful and controlled, usually traced some living species on Jijo's complex order of life. Dwyer used Lark's cast-off notes to store seeds, herbs, and feathers, things useful in the hunt. Sarah's hand was expansive, yet tense, as if imagination and order held each other in check. Her discards swarmed with baffling mathematics. Some failed equations weren't just scratched out, but stabbed to death in fits of frustration. Dwyer used his sister's worksheets to hold medicines, condiments, and the powders that made many Jijoan foods edible to humans. From one folded page he drew 6 tobar seeds, plump, hard, and fragrant, which he spread across a rock some way downwind. Holding his breath, he used his knife to split one open, then fled a rising, pungent cloud. The glaiver mewed unhappily, and the Noor glared at him until the breeze swept most of the intense aroma away. Back in his sleeping roll, Dwyer waited as the stars came out. Kalanudi was a hot, reddish pinpoint, set high on the leering face of Sargon, pitiless enforcer of laws. More starry patterns followed. Eagle, horse, dragon, and dolphin, beloved cousin, grinning with her jaw thrust in a direction some said might lead to Earth. If we exiles are ever caught, Dwyer pondered, will the Great Galactic Library make a file about our culture, our myths? Will aliens read our constellation myths and laugh? If all went as planned, no one would ever hear of this lonely colony or recall its tales. Our descendants, if any, will be like glaivers, simple and innocent as the beasts of the field. Fluttering wings grazed the firelight. A squat form landed near the tobar seeds with wings of grayish plates that slid like overlapping petals. The birdling's yellow beak quickly devoured the nut Dwyer had cracked. Mudfoot sat up, eyes glinting. Dwyer warned the Noor, half-dozing, "You bother it, and I'll have your hide for a hat." Mudfoot sniffed and lay down again. Soon there came a rhythmic tapping as the teat started pecking at the next nut. It would take its time, consuming one kernel each midura, roughly 70 minutes, until the last was gone. Then, with a chattering screech, it would fly off. One didn't need a printout from the Great Library to know what function the Boyer had designed this creature to fill. The living alarm clock still worked as programmed. "Lark is wrong about our place on this world," Dwyer thought, lulled by the unvaried tapping. "We do a service. Jijo would be a sad place without people to use its gifts." There were dreams. Dwyer always had dreams. Shapeless foes lurked beyond sight as he wandered a land covered with colors, like a rainbow that had melted, flowed across the ground, then frozen in place. The harsh hues hurt his eyes. Moreover, his throat felt parched, and he was unarmed. The dream shifted. All of a sudden, he found himself alone in a forest of trees that seemed to stretch up past the moons. For some reason, the trees were even more threatening than the colored landscape. He fled, but could find no exit from the forest as their trunks glowed, burst into flame, then started to explode. The furious intensity of the nightmare yanked him awake. sitting up with a racing heart. Durr stared wide-eyed, glad to find the real woods intact, though dark and threaded by a chill breeze. There was no raging firestorm. He had dreamed the whole thing. Still, uneasiness gnawed. Something felt wrong. He rubbed his eyes. Different constellations swarmed the sky, fading in the east under a wash of pre-dawn gray. The biggest moon, Lucen, hovered over silhouetted peaks, its sunlit face spangled with bright pinpoints, the domes of long-abandoned cities. So what's wrong? It wasn't just intuition. The clock, Teat, had stopped. Something must have disturbed it before the time to chatter its alarm. He checked the area and found the Noor snoring on quietly. The Glaiver tracked Dwer dully with one thoughtless eye, the other still closed. All at once, he knew the problem. My bow! It wasn't where he'd left it, within arm's reach. It was gone. Stolen. Anger flooded the pre-dawn dimness with blinding adrenaline outrage. Dozens had spoken enviously of his bow, a masterpiece of laminated wood and bone, fashioned by the Kelwynish craftsmen of Ovum Town. But who? Calm down. Think. Could it be Jenny Shen? She often joked about luring him into a poker game with the bow at stake. Or might it be... Stop. He took a deep breath, but it was hard disciplining his young body, so full of need to act. Stop and hear what the world has to say. First, he must calm the furious spilling of his own unspoken words. Dwer pushed aside all noisy thoughts. Next, he made himself ignore the rasping sound of breath and pulse. The distant muttering waterfall was by now familiar, easy to cancel out. The wind's rustle, less regular, soon went away too. One hovering sound might be the clock Teat cruising in hope of more tobar seeds. Another flutter told of a honey bat, no, a mated pair, which he also disregarded. The Noor's snoring, he edited, and the soft grind of Glaiver molars as the prisoner re-chewed her cud. There. Dwer turned his head. Was that a scrape on gravel? Pebbles rattling down a scree, perhaps? Something or someone. Bipedal? Almost man-size, he guessed, and hurrying away. Dwer took off after the sound. Gliding ghost-like in his moccasins, he ran some distance before noting that the thief was heading in the wrong direction. Away from the coast, away from the slope, higher into the Rimmer Range, toward the pass. Padding up the rocky trail, Dwer's angry flush gave way to the scrupulous cadence of pursuit, a tense, almost ecstatic concentration on each thrust of heel and toe, the efficiency of motion needed for silence, an eager probing beyond his own soft noise to seize any trace of the pursued. His head felt clear, no longer poisoned by fury. Whatever the reason for this chase, he could not help feeling a kind of joy. This was his art, the thing he loved best. Dwer was near the notch of gray light separating two shadowy peaks when a problem occurred to him. Wait a minute. He slowed to a trot, then down to a walk. This is stupid. Here I am chasing off after a sound I'm not even sure I heard, maybe a hangover of a dream, when the answer was there all along. The Noor. He stopped, beating his fist against his thigh and feeling like an idiot. It's just what a Noor would do, stealing things, swapping a villager's chipped cup for a treasure or vice versa. When he returned, would a pile of ligger turds sit where the bow had lain? Or a diamond wrested from the crown of some long-dead boyar king? Or would they all, Noor, bow, and glavers, simply be gone? Mudfoot had been quite an actor, snoozing by the coals. Did the beast cackle when he hightailed off, chasing his own outraged imagination? And alongside anger, there arose a grudging appreciation. A good one. He really got me. Then again, this Noor might have a surprise coming. Of all the humans on Jijo, perhaps only Dwur was qualified to find the beast and get even. It would be a difficult chase, maybe impossible, or else the hunt of a lifetime. Sudden insight filled Dwur with wonder. Was that the Noor's gift? To offer Dwur? Ahead of him, in the vague dimness, the corner of a shadow moved. His unfocused eyes had been opened to peripheral vision, habituated to a static scene. A reflex hunter's trick that made one specially sensitive to motion, as when a boulder shifted to the left, then moved onward toward the pass. Ears snatched distant tickling scrapes, softer than the wind. Dwyer's eyebrows knotted as he started forward again, slowly at first, then stealthily faster. When the blurry shadow stopped, he stopped, splaying his arms for balance. Profiled against pre-dawn gray, the silhouette waited a few duras more, then turned and continued on its way. Trust your instincts, Fallon the tracker used to teach. The old man was nobody's fool. Mudfoot had been the obvious suspect. Perhaps that was why it didn't occur to Dwur back at the campsite. He would have wasted valuable time blaming the logical culprit. His first impulse had been right, after all. The initial clue, a true one. The shadow turned again. Dwur traced a human shape, alarm now, fleeing with his purloined bow. This time he sprinted, forsaking stealth for speed. Pebbles flew, rattling the pass with echoes. The others swiveled too, leaping away like a striped gussel in flight. Only three humans on Jijo could outrun Dwur, and none at all in rough terrain. End game, he thought, bearing down for a final dash. When his quarry turned, he was ready. When it drew a knife, he knew this was no joke. Dwur launched into a tackling dive, primed to hear shouts of anger and dismay. Unexpected was the thief's face, looming as he hurtled forward. Human. Female. Terribly young. Above all, a complete and total stranger.
Asks. Fate had fallen from the sky, to Jijo, to the slope, to the glade of gathering, to the nexus of our fears much sooner than expected. Across megaparsecs, a ship from the five galaxies had come. Such a vast distance. The least we poor exiles could do was march a short way to where it landed and courteously greet it. Vubbin declined the honor of leading. Jijo's gravity so hobbles our dear Gekek, they must rely solely on wheels, using their stilt legs for balance only, moving over rough ground almost as slowly as a treiki. So Vubbin and I hobbled along, urging our Hoon, Kewanish, human, and Urish counterparts to forge ahead. Do I, we, sense a foul odor of envy fuming in our central core? Do some of you, my several selves, resent our awkward slowness compared to those long Hoonish legs or nimble Urish feet? Things might have been different had our Treiki exile ship come equipped with the full menagerie of rings our kin were said to own. Legends tell of adroit running limbs, gifts of the mighty Oaili, limbs to make even a heavy stack like ours as speedy as a song jackal, speedy as a jofer. But then would we also have carried Oaili arrogance, their madness? Would we have fought wars the way Kewans and Urs and Hoons and men did for centuries here on Jijo, bickering until the commons grew strong enough for peace? Those Treiki who fled to Jijo had reasons to leave some rings behind, or so we believe. But again, digression thwarts our tale. Discipline my rings, give the fumes another spin, stroke the waxy imprints, and remember. Recall how we marched, each at Ur's own pace, toward the side valley where the intruder ship had set down. Along the way, Vubbin recited from the Book of Exile, greatest of scrolls, the one least altered by quarrel, heresy, or waves of new arrivals. "The right to live is tentative," Vubbin chanted in a voice that seemed to caress the soul. "Material things are limited, though the mind is free, of protein, phosphorus, nor even energy is there ever enough to slake all hungers. Therefore, show not a front when diverse beings vie over what physically exists. Only in thought can there be true generosity. So let thought be the focus of your world." Vubbin's voice had a calming way with our people. The slim, bold welpel trees seemed to resonate his words, tuned as they are to the music of the egg. And yet, while Vubbin spoke of equanimity, our basal segment kept trying to stop, turn its feet around, and carry us away. Dimly, that bottommost ring realized that danger lay ahead, and sensibly voted to flee. Our upper tiers had to apply scent throbs to urge it onward. We find strange how fear functions in non-Treiki. They say it infuses all parts of a body, and hence must be fought everywhere at once. Once, we asked Lester Campbell how humans keep calm in times of crisis. His answer was that generally they don't. How strange. Humans always seem so much in control. Is it just a grand act to fool both others and themselves? "Do not digress, asks. Stroke the wax. Go on. Go on toward the ship."
Sarah. Henrik seemed reluctant to set off his charges. At first this surprised Sarah. Wasn't this crisis what an exploser always dreamed of? A chance to make things go boom? To destroy works that others spent their lives building? In fact, Henrik seemed less avid than many of the citizens crowding the meeting tree in panic that night after witnessing a fireball rattle the forest to its ancient roots. Two gardeners and a worker chimp had fallen from high branches to their deaths, and scores of others had had narrow escapes. The farmers were in a state. Carved from the spacious heart knot of a grandfather Garu, the great hall was crammed with nearly every sapient adult within a rapid day's hike. Like a steaming minnow pie, the room seemed stuffed with perspiring humanity. A cluster of other folk were also present, Hoon sailors, mostly, their pale, scaly skins and shaggy white leg fur offset by dark green cloaks, cinched with wooden brooches below their puffing throat sacks. Some also wore trembling rauk over their eyes to help interpret this stew of human emotions. Near the north entrance, where it was less humid, a few Irish tinkers chafed and stamped, uneasily switching their braided tails. Sarah even spied one forlorn Gekek pilgrim, anxious green sweat dripping from a single eye stalk, while the other three lay curled like socks in a drawer, hiding from the raucous ferment. Dr. Lorick had been wise, it seemed, volunteering to spend the evening watching the wounded stranger. Pizora, the town pharmacist, had a defense against having Ur's lower rings trampled. If pressed too closely, the tracheae just vented a little pungent steam, and even the most agitated citizen gave Ur room. No doubt it was like this wherever folk had seen the dread specter in the sky. Right now, human visitors were attending Kewin or Hoon assemblies and even Urish tribal conclaves beside roaring fires on the open plains. "The Great Peace is our finest accomplishment," Sarah thought. "Maybe it will weigh in our favor when we're judged. We've come far since the days of war and slaughter." Alas, from the rancor of tonight's meeting, the commons still had a long way to go.
"Minor repairs!"
Chaz Langmuir, the master carpenter, protested from the stage, normally used for concerts and theatricals.
"We're talking about losing everything below the floodline, and that don't count the dam itself. You ask how many years to rebuild. If this turns out to be a false alarm, let's talk lifetimes."
Merchants and craft workers supported Langmuir with shouts, but were opposed by cries of "shame" from many wearing the gray garb of farmers. Overhead, excited ape-like shrieks joined in. Though not voting citizens, tradition let local chimps clamber up the wall tapestries to observe from slit vents high above. How much they understood was debatable. Some screamed lustily for whichever speaker seemed most impassioned, while others were as partisan as Sarah's father, who clapped the carpenters back with encouragement. It had gone this way for hours. Angry men and women taking turns citing scripture or bemoaning costs, each side waxing ever louder as their fear and irritation grew. Nor were humans the sole partisans. Logbiter, matriarch of the local Kewinish hive, had spoken urgently for preserving Dolo Dam, while her cousin from Logjam Pond proclaimed it a gaudy monstrosity. Sarah feared a melee would ensue between two huge armored matrons, until the chief elder, Fru Nestor, interposed her small human form, the rauk on her brow flashing soothing colors, until both Kewins finally backed down. The audience was no better. A woman stepped on Sarah's foot. Someone else must not have bathed this week, comparing badly to Pizora's worst secretions. Sarah envied Pretty, a tiny figure perched high in a windowsill next to several human kids too young to vote. Unlike other chimps, she seemed to find her notebook more engaging than the shouting speakers, tugging at her lower lip while she studied lines of complex mathematics. Sarah envied Pretty's escape into abstraction. One of the tree farmers rose to speak, a dark man named Jop, whose pale yellow hair curled around his ears. He clenched two large hands, knotty with lifelong calluses.
"Penny-pinching and far-sightedness,"
Jop dismissed the carpenter's plea.
"What would you preserve? A few workshops and docks, passing toys like plumbing and paper? Dross, all dross. some paltry comforts that our sinner ancestors let us poor exiles keep for a while, softening our first steps on the road toward grace. But the scrolls say none of it will last. It's all destined for the sea."
Jopp turned to his partisans, clutching both hands together.
"It was planned long ago, what we're sworn to do when starships come. Or else, why have we supported a guild of explosers all this time?"
Sarah glanced again at Henrik and son, seated at the back of the dais. The boy, Joma, betrayed unease with a slow twisting of his cap between nervous young hands. But his pa might have been a statue. Henrik had remained silent throughout, except to report tersely that his charges were ready. Sarah always pictured their craft as a frustrating profession, probably unique to Jijo. After so many years of preparation, performing endless tests in a small canyon in the hills, wouldn't they hanker to see it all finally put to use? "I know I would." Long ago, she and Lark and Little Dwer used to sit in their attic room watching moonlight spill over the rambling water wheel and thrilling each other with lurid tales of what they might see if ever the moment came when Henrik lit his fuses. With delicious mock terror pounding in their chests, they counted down heartbeats until kablam! Dwer loved making sound effects, especially the pretend detonation that finished off the dam, accompanied by waving arms and lots of saliva. Sarah's younger brother then gleefully described the wall of water tossing proud boats like trifles, smashing Nello's drying racks, and driving toward their bedroom window like a fist. Lark took over then, thrilling and terrifying the younger kids as he portrayed their attic being sheared off by a watery blast, sent careening through the Garou forest while farmers stared down in pity. Each pretend near miss made Sarah and Dwer cry out till they leaped on their laughing older brother, pummeling to make him stop. And yet, after Dwer and Lark had done their best to scare her, they would toss and turn, while Sarah never had nightmares. When she did dream about the dam bursting, she used to picture a great wave simply taking them in the palm of its gentle hand. As froth concealed all of Jijo, it magically transformed into the fluffy, charged substance of a cloud. Always the fantasy ended with her body lighter than mist, fearless, soaring through a night radiant with stars. A roar of approval yanked her back to the present. At first, she could not tell if it came from the party wanting quick action, or from those resolved not to wreck 9 generations of work on the mere evidence of their own eyes.
"We have no idea what it was we saw," her father declared, combing his beard with gnarled fingers. "Can we be sure it was a spaceship? Perhaps a meteor grazed by. That'd explain all the noise and ruckus."
Sneers and foot stamps greeted this suggestion. Nello hurried on.
"Even if it was a ship, that don't mean we've been discovered. Other vessels have come and gone. Zhang globes, for instance, come to siphon water from the sea. Did we wreck everything then? Did the older tribes burn their towns when we humans came? How do we know it wasn't another sneak ship, bringing a 7th exile race to join our commons?"
Jopp snorted derisively.
"Let me remind the learned papermaker, sneak ships sneak. They come under the shadow of night and cloud and mountain peak. This new vessel made no such effort. It aimed straight at the glade of the egg, at a time when the pavilions of gathering are there, along with the chief sages of the 6. "Exactly," Nello cried.
By now the sages should be well aware of the situation, and would have far-cast if they felt it necessary to.
Far-casting? Jopp interrupted. Are you serious? The sages remind us over and over again that it can't be trusted. In a crisis, far-casts may be just the thing to attract attention, or else...
Jopp paused meaningfully.
Or else there may have been no calls for a more terrible reason.
He let the implication sink in amid a scatter of gasps. Almost everyone present had a relative or close friend who had taken pilgrimage this year.